Iran warns that the U.S. and Israel are plotting to create a security crisis in Syria. At least 6 people are killed in 2 separate terrorist attacks in the north and south of Iraq. And U.S. military experts visit Ukraine to enhance its air defense as tensions continue to soar in the region amid Washington-Moscow showdown over the former Russian Republic. Hello and welcome to World News from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran, where the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the United States is seeking to rehabilitate the Daesh terror group in the region. Ali Shabkhani made the remarks in a meeting with a visiting Syrian foreign minister in Tehran. He said the United States is furious over the defeat of the terror group and is seeking to destabilize the West Asia region. Iranian official warned of a plot designed by the United States and Israel to create a security crisis in Syria. Shamkhani said any aggression and occupation will end in a humiliating defeat. For his part, the Syrian top diplomat said the illegal U.S. presence violates Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He added that Washington is seeking to create terrorist cells to harm stability in his country. Political analyst Fuad Ezzaidi has joined us with his take on visits by the Syrian foreign minister and the UAE national security advisor to Tehran. He explains how those meetings signify Iran's role in the region.
The United States is a country in decline, and a number of American allies in this part of the world are realizing it. They are realizing that the Trump administration's lack of interest in supporting its allies in this part of the world has continued, and the Biden administration is more or less following the same policy. And this is because the United States did the power in decline. The way they left Afghanistan, they ran away from Afghanistan. The way they failed in Syria and in Yemen and in Lebanon and Iraq and elsewhere is an indication that relying on the United States is not going to be a good foreign policy option. Because of that fact, UAE, at least, it is realizing that working with Iran, having better relations with Iran is going to be their interest, because the United States is not going to be an effective power in this part of the world.
Iran's deputy foreign minister defends the 2 draft proposals Tehran has presented to the other signatories of the 2015 nuclear agreement during the recent talks in Vienna. He says the drafts are based on the documents already agreed upon by the 2 sides.
In fact, the reforms and proposals we've presented about the 2 final drafts of the 6th round of talks in Vienna were based on joint texts of the 2 sides. In other words, the texts were presented were not baseless demands or expectations. Rather, they were based on the documents agreed upon by both Iran and the P4+1 group.
Bagheri Khani made the comments in Moscow, where he held talks with Russian officials. He stressed that the 2 draft proposals are not new, rather are in compliance with the text of the previous rounds of talks in Vienna, with some amendments. He also confirmed that the Vienna talks will resume on Thursday. European signatories, including Britain, France, and Germany, have expressed dismay over Iran's proposals, saying they go against the terms of the 2015 nuclear accord. Tehran has already called on the other sides to make use of the window of opportunity, saying it will not remain open forever. And now to Iraq, where at least 6 civilians and security personnel have been killed in separate attacks in Basra. Local police say a motorcycle laden with explosives went off in the city center near a hospital and a popular market. According to officials, at least 20 people have been injured. Videos posted online show a column of black smoke rising from the site of the explosion. Separately, at least two soldiers have been killed in a bomb explosion in Wad al-Shai district in the northern province of Kirkuk. So far, there's no claim of responsibility for the attacks, but officials are pointing the finger at Daesh. The terror group has been carrying out sporadic attacks in Iraq since its defeat in 2017. Moving on to other news now this hour, turning to Yemen, where the Yemeni army says it has carried out large-scale operation against Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's deadly assaults and continued siege. Army spokesman says a large number of drones and ballistic missiles were launched against military sites and other key locations in the Saudi cities of Abha, Jazan, Asir, and the capital Riyadh. Yahya Saidi says the army also targeted Aramco oil facilities in Jeddah. He called the military sites legitimate targets of the Yemeni army and urged Saudi residents living near those areas to evacuate. This as the Saudi-led coalition has stepped up its attacks on the war-torn country in recent days. In their latest attacks, the kingdom's warplanes bombed the Sawan residential area twice in the Yemeni capital on Tuesday. Meanwhile, the Yemeni Civil Aviation Authority and Meteorology has held a rally in Sana'a to mark World Civil Aviation Day. Now, participants say Saudi Arabia's continued closure of the airport in Sana'a has contributed to the worsening humanitarian situation in the country. Our correspondent in Yemen, Abdulatif Al-Washadli, reports.
Inside the closed Sana'a International Airport, Yemen's Civil Aviation Authority held a protest rally to mark World Civil Aviation Day. A number of state officials participated in the protest and slammed the continued closure of Sana'a Airport by the Saudi-led coalition.
Today, we, like the rest of the world, celebrate the World Civil Aviation Day. This day means a lot for us as civil aviation workers, but unfortunately it comes as Yemen's airports are closed and being targeted in Saudi-led air raids. Sana'a Airport especially is being bombed in an unjustified way. The justifications made by the Saudi-led coalition that Sana'a Airport is being used for military purposes are incorrect. The United Nations is aware of the airport's activity and has daily flights through Sana'a Airport.
Protesters demanded the reopening of Sana'a Airport and called on the international community to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen. They held the UN responsible for not taking any action against Saudi violations.
Over 100,000 patients with chronic diseases have died due to the continued closure of Sana'a Airport, and there are about 400,000 more who are suffering from the shutdown. There are also 1 million patients who suffer from a lack of medicine that need refrigeration and must arrive through Sana'a Airport. The humanitarian situation is tragic and reflects the scale of the tragedy that Yemenis are experiencing due to the ongoing Saudi blockade.
6 years ago, Saudi Arabia imposed restrictions on Yemen's airspace and shut down Sana'a Airport. The closure has led to the death of tens of thousands of patients, including children, who needed to travel abroad for treatment unavailable in Yemen due to the collapse of the healthcare system.
Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this closed airport, which is only receiving the United Nations flights. People here say the airport should also be closed to the UN to push the world body to take real measures against the Saudi blockade imposed on Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Well, French police have reportedly arrested one of the suspects involved in the brutal killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. French police source says prosecutors will begin proceedings for the extradition of the suspect to Turkey. Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S.-based journalist and critic of the Saudi regime, was killed and then dismembered in the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul in October of 2018. His brutal killing drew international condemnation. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Saudi crown prince and de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman. Palestinian resistance groups say they believe that resistance is the most strategic and viable option against the Israeli occupation. In a joint statement ahead of the anniversary of the First Intifada, our popular uprising, resistance groups also condemned any normalization deal with Israel. They said all Arab nations that have normalized ties with the regime are partner in the ongoing Israeli crimes against Palestinians. They also stressed the need for support to Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails, especially those on hunger strikes. The Intifada was a sustained Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation and atrocities and erupted in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip on December the 8th, 1987. U.S. military experts have visited Ukraine to help the country develop its air defenses. Now, the visit comes amid escalating tensions between Washington and Moscow over Russia's military buildup near its western neighbor. The U.S. has recently been warning of a Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine. Russia has rejected the accusations as alarmist and an attempt to artificially stir up hysteria. However, Moscow has expressed grave concerns about any escalation in the ongoing conflict inside of Ukraine. It says NATO's buildup in Eastern Europe has encouraged Kiev to use force against the self-proclaimed republics in the Donbas region. Russia says a peaceful resolution of the conflict can only be achieved through the implementation of peace accords signed in Minsk in 2014 and 2015.
Сегодня будет у нас.
Today, there will be significant events in their relations. Phone contact, video contact between Presidents Putin and Biden. We definitely will be clearly stating our approaches to Ukrainian resolution, to the importance of making Kiev regime fulfill their written in black and white obligations under the Minsk set of measures. Apparently, Kiev won't listen to anyone except for the United States of America.
The situation surrounding Ukraine will feature extensively in a virtual meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden on Tuesday. Biden has stressed that he wouldn't accept the imposition of any Russian red lines. The U.S. has warned that it would send reinforcements to NATO's eastern flank in response to a Russian attack against Ukraine. Washington's Western allies, including the EU and the UK, have also threatened more sanctions against Russia and more military support for Ukraine. President Putin, meanwhile, has asserted that NATO's further eastward expansion is unacceptable for Moscow. He has asked for legal guarantees from the U.S.-led bloc that it would stop encroaching upon Russia's borders and refrain from deploying threatening weapons in the region.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas, and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation in all-out technology and trade blockade and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity inside. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to this could be long-term security guarantees on its Western borders. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The U.S. diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing is drawing an angry response from China, with its foreign ministry warning that Washington will pay a price for its mistakes.
The actions of the United States seriously violate the principle of political neutrality in sports as established by the Olympic Charter and runs counter to the more united Olympic model. It stands on the opposite side of the majority of athletes and sports enthusiasts around the world.
The ministry says Washington's plot to disrupt the international event will fail and that Beijing is prepared to take countermeasures. It warned that the decision would lead to a loss of U.S. moral authority and credibility. The State Department has said that U.S. government officials will not be attending the games because of alleged human rights violations. The decision, though, will not affect American athletes who will still compete in the games. The standoff over the Olympics is adding to a long list of disputes between China and the U.S., including trade, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and the origins of COVID. And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldless edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The limelight.
U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has said Texas's redistricting plan would violate the Voting Rights Act by discriminating against minority voters. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Katie Benner, Nick Coresaniti, and Reed Epstein. The piece is titled Justice Department Files Voting Rights Suit Against Texas over new map. The U.S. Justice Department sued Texas on Monday, 6th of December, over the state's plan to redraw its voting districts, saying it would essentially make ballots cast by black and Latino voters count for less than those of others. In announcing the lawsuit, Attorney General Merrick Garland said that the redistricting plan that the state's Republican-led legislature approved in October violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which says that voters cannot be denied equal access to the political process based on their race or ethnicity. The lawsuit was the second in a little over a month to be filed by the Justice Department challenging Texas over voting. the department sued the state in early November over a new voting law that it argued would disenfranchise Texans who do not speak English, people with disabilities, older voters, and those who live outside of the United States. The lawsuit filed by the department on Monday also puts other states on notice as they redraw their voting districts, a process that occurs once a decade. 17 states have already finalized congressional maps this year, with more expected to complete the process before the spring. The Texas plan not only denies Black and Latino voters the equal opportunity to participate in the election process, some aspects of the plan were created with discriminatory intent, Associate Attorney General Vanita Gupta said at a news conference. The lawsuit laid out several examples where minority districts were eliminated altogether or redrawn in such a way that minority voters in urban areas were newly counted in rural, predominantly white areas. In the case of voters in Dallas, those new districts could extend more than 100 miles from the city center. The suit intensified a running battle between the Biden administration and Texas, a state that defied federal guidance on the use of face masks to stop the spread of COVID-19 and that passed a near-total ban on abortion that the U.S. Justice Department in another lawsuit has called unconstitutional. Ken Paxton, Texas's Attorney General, called the redistricting lawsuit absurd and a ploy by the Biden administration. "I'm confident that our legislature's redistricting decisions will be proven lawful, and this preposterous attempt to sway democracy will fail," Ken Paxton said on Twitter. Lawsuit, even if it succeeds, is unlikely to change the enacted Texas maps before the midterm elections next November, when control of Congress is at stake. A decade ago, litigation over Republican-drawn districts in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and elsewhere took years before courts ordered new lines drawn. The Texas candidate filing deadline is next week, and primary elections are set for 1st of March. The federal lawsuit will face significant hurdles in court. Unlike in past decades, Texas did not have to submit its maps for prior clearance by the U.S. Justice Department under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court neutered in 2013. The Justice Department now has the burden of proving the Texas maps violate federal law, as opposed to Texas being required to demonstrate they're legal. The Supreme Court decision also eliminated the ability to sue states under the Voting Rights Act in federal court in Washington, D.C. Instead, the lawsuit against Texas was filed in El Paso, meaning any appeal would go through the Fifth Circuit, which is stacked with conservative judges. They have a major home court advantage in Texas because you go to the Fifth Circuit, said Tom Perez, a former head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division and former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who is now running for the governor of Maryland. Tom Perez added, "The oldest play in the far-right playbook, whether it's voting rights, abortion rights, labor rights, is go to court in Texas." The lawsuit follows a 2019 Supreme Court ruling that significantly weakened the legal grounds for challenging voter maps. In Rocho v. Common Cause, the court ruled that partisan gerrymandering, maps designed to favor a political party, could not be challenged in federal court, though racial gerrymandering remained unconstitutional. The Justice Department does have an advantage from one element of the law, though the lawsuit makes numerous claims that Texas lawmakers drew intentionally discriminatory maps. There is no requirement that the Justice Department prove intent to successfully challenge the Texas maps under the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act set up vote dilution, and vote dilution does not have to prove intent, said Thomas Sanez, the president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. The lawsuit over redistricting comes as President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats face pressure to challenge Republican state legislatures around the nation that have sought to curb voting access. Even though the Justice Department has sued Georgia and Texas over laws limiting ballot access and filed statements of support in lawsuits brought by private plaintiffs in Florida and Arizona about laws in those states, those new statutes could be in effect for multiple election cycles before the courts decide whether they are constitutional. Merrick Garland said the Biden administration has only a limited ability to keep states from enacting discriminatory voting laws, even though the Justice Department has prioritized the issue and doubled its enforcement staff, because the 2013 Supreme Court decision ended the department's authority to approve or deny voting laws and redistricting plans before they went into effect. He asked Congress on Monday, 6th of December, to restore that power to the Justice Department through legislation, and said the Texas redistricting plan and other measures that the administration believes curbs minority access to the ballot box would not have been enacted if the department had retained that authority. Currently, there are two bills stuck in the Democratic-controlled yet deadlocked Congress, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, that would seek to both roll back some of the new restrictions on voting and restore the oversight powers of the U.S. Justice Department. But with near unanimous Republican opposition to both bills, there is little likelihood of passage without reforming Senate rules, a path multiple Democrats, including Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, do not support. I don't know what more is going to take before the U.S. Senate realizes that Republicans have zero interest in having fair voting rights in this country, said Trey Martinez Fisher, a Democratic Texas state representative who organized his colleagues to flee the state in July to delay the passage of Republicans of new voting restrictions in the state. The 2020 census showed that non-Latino white Texans now comprise less than 40% of the state's population, the Justice Department lawsuit said. But the lawsuit said that the redistricting plan created by Republicans refused to recognize the state's growing minority electorate. Texas's population jumped by 4 million between 2010 and 2020. And the increase in the number of minority residents accounted for 95% of that overall growth. Career lawyers in the U.S. Justice Department's Civil Rights Division found that the state's new voting districts will dilute the increased minority voting strength that should have developed from these shifts. Vanita Gupta said, while Texas will gain two additional congressional seats based on millions of new minority citizens, the Justice Department found that those seats will have white voting majorities. The redistricting plan also surgically excised minority communities from the core of the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area metroplex by attaching them to heavily Anglo rural counties, some more than 100 miles away, the Justice Department lawsuit said. Based on the population changes, the lawsuit said that proportional representation for Latino voters in Texas would be 11 congressional seats and 45 Texas House seats, but that the new maps provide just 7 congressional seats and 29 Texas House seats. The Justice Department is asking the courts to force Texas to create and implement a new redistricting plan and to establish interim plans that remedy the components of its current redistricting plan that are deemed to be unlawful.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, أو you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimjid.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Faqad qala Allahu al-Hakim fi kitabihi al-mubin, bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa min ayatihi an khalaqa lakum min anfusikum azwajan litaskunu ilayha. وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّةً وَرَحْمَةً إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَاتٍ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ. I want to look at the topic of marriage. What is the position of the Quran and Islam on the sacred reunion of marriage and family relationships? Now, obviously, this is a huge, vast topic, and it covers so many different areas that I know we will not be able to do justice to the entire topic tonight, but we will, inshallah, try and do our best to grasp at least the basics of this very important issue, which will either affect us right now or it will affect each and every one of us going forward in the future. And so, coming to the verse that I began with, I just want to analyze two words in this verse where Allah says, وَمِنْ آيَاتِهِ أَنْ خَلَقَ لَكُمْ مِنْ أَنْفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا لِتَسْكُنُوا إِلَيْهَا وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّةً وَرَحْمَةً إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَاتٍ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. Chapter 30, Surah Al-Rum, verse 21. Allah talks about two concepts, mawadda and rahma. Mawadda and rahma have been interpreted by our scholars of the Quran, those mufassirun, the commentators of the Quran. They've explained or tried to explain these words in many different ways. And we don't want to say that one way is right and the other way is wrong. No, I would say that it is actually a combination of all of the interpretations. Because as you and I know, that Arabic is a very deep language. It's very nuanced. The words Allah chose in the Quran are for a purpose. They have a very deep meaning. And so we need to delve into the depth of the ayat of the Quran in every single word sometimes, to truly grasp the contents and the concepts Allah wants you and I to know, to make that positive change in our lives. Again, not because Allah needs it, but we need Islam. We need the Quran. So, for example, in his tafsir, Ayatollah Sheikh Nasir Makarim Shirazi in Tafsir Namuna, which is also available in Arabic as Al-Amthal, he gives three opinions of what mawadda and rahma could mean. He says that mawadda is the beginning of the relationship between the man and the woman, the friendship that they have. This motivation of friendship gets them to, you know, talk to one another, to get married. They have love, but it's more of a friend relationship in the early stages of their marriage. That's the mawadda, he says, one interpretation. But later on, as they have been married for a year, 5 years, 10, 20, 50 years, let's say, that friendship changes into compassion, rahma, concern for one another. Right? So that's one interpretation. It goes from friendship to compassion. It goes from a very superficial kind of liking for your spouse, because you're just getting to know them and acquainted and accustomed to who they are and how they live and what they do and what their idiosyncrasies are, how they do certain things in life. And then it changes into compassion. It grows, that love matures and flourishes into compassion. The second interpretation that Sheikh Nasir Makarim Shirazi gives is that mawadda is the need to serve the spouse, and rahma is the need to take care of one another. So it's to serve them, to help them when they need some help. So the wife comes home from work, or she's been taking care of the children all day, and the husband comes home, and no doubt the husband is tired. But mawadda is that he will, you know, say, you know what, let me cook the food tonight. Let me help you do the dishes. Let me help you load the dishwasher. Let me help take the kids and put them to sleep. Or let me take the kids out to the park or, you know, for a walk. And you can have some quiet time on your own to relax or to connect to Allah or just to, you know, put your feet up and take it easy for a while. That's the serving of the spouse. And then rahmah is to take care of the spouse. The third opinion that Ayatollah Nasser Makarem gives is that mawadda is that which is reciprocated between the husband and the wife. It's what you give into the relationship. And rahmah is what you take out of it. And so if the husband and wife are both giving, somebody is receiving. And if they're both receiving, somebody also has to give. So the third opinion is mawadda and rahmah. These two qualities that Allah again has put, وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَكُمْ. Allah has, جَعَلَ, He has put بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّ وَرَحْمَ. It's the give and take, right? It's the fact that the husband and wife are working along with one another. It's not a battle of the sexes. It's not a war inside the family. It's not, I want my way and you don't get what you want. It's, I need this, but I recognize that you also have needs in life. Let me give and you take. And the other partner says, I also appreciate the fact that you have needs. I will also give and you can take from me. This, in a nutshell, is what Allah means, or one of the interpretations at least of what Allah means, of جَعَلَ بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّةَ وَرَحْمَةً. But then Sheikh Nasser Makarem goes on and he mentions a point which is very interesting, in which he says that don't only think that this is related to the husband and the wife, give and take, love and respect, compassion and assistance. He says that there's also a strong possibility that this should or can be understood as being related to the entire family. So our children, our young boys and girls, or if they're teenagers or whatever age they are, they also have to realize, and the parents first and foremost, have to treat the children with mawadda and rahma. They have to realize that children have needs. Children aren't as, let's say, intelligent as the parents. They haven't seen as much as the parents have seen. And so the parents have to deal with the children with mawadda and rahma. And as the children see the mother and father dealing with them with love and care and compassion and mercy and respect, so too will the children learn that they need to give that back to their mother and father. So they'll treat their children, their mother and father, with respect. Just like we see in the times of the Prophet, that when Lady Zahra alayhi salam would enter the room, the Prophet would stand, he would kiss her hand, he would ask her to sit where he was sitting. He gave his daughter that respect. And as parents, we also need to ensure that we give our children respect if we want respect back. We have to give our children love if we want them to love us back.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Western governments and their militaries systematically play down civilian casualties in their foreign wars. We now present you an article written jointly by Lauren Gould, Joel Demers, and Nora Stell. The piece is titled Collateral Damage: Crushing the Myths of Modern Warfare. U.S. military is facing charges that covered up civilian casualties cases in the so-called war against Daesh. It's an issue that has drawn attention to one of the most worrying aspects of U.S. and coalition involvement in West Asia, the large numbers of civilian casualties, or what has come to be known as collateral damage. On 13th of November, the New York Times revealed that more than 70 people had been killed in an F-15 airstrike on the Syrian town of Baghouz in 2019. Legal officers flagged the incident as a possible war crime at the time and requested an investigation. But this investigation never took place. Instead, information on the airstrike was buried. Inconvenient questions were ignored. Reports were deleted, sanitized, and classified. And defense analyst Gene Tate, the whistleblower in question, was fired. Only after he finally turned to the media did the Pentagon acknowledge that there had been 80 deaths. That these casualties were civilians was not acknowledged, and nor was the potential for this to have been a war crime. The Pentagon claimed that the civilian identity of the people killed was impossible to determine, because women and children in Daesh sometimes took up arms. Baghouz airstrike is not an isolated event. Recent research on a Dutch-led coalition airstrike on a Daesh weapons factory in the Iraqi town of Khawaja in 2015 that killed more than 70 civilians shows that neither the shocking civilian death toll nor its denial and cover-up are unique. Dutch politicians initially denied responsibility for any civilian casualties, then attempted to keep civilian casualty numbers classified in the name of operational security. When journalists irrefutably demonstrated that the Khawaja attack had been carried out by the Netherlands, officials claimed nobody could know if the people killed were civilians or Daesh terrorists. This denying that casualties take place and questioning their civilian identity is a systematic feature of the remote war waged against Daesh Takfiri terrorists. Respected monitoring agency Air Wars estimates that between 8,150 and 13,174 civilians have been killed in the wake of the 35,000 airstrikes that were conducted since the war began in 2014, and which destroyed more than 70% of cities such as Mosul in northern Iraq and Raqqa in Syria. Yet the coalition as a whole acknowledges just over 10% of these, that is 1,417. The US-led coalition's purported war against Daesh is a good example of how advanced militaries are turning to remote warfare. Remote warfare is characterized by a shift away from boots on the ground. It involves drone and airstrikes and special operation teams training local forces to do the actual fighting and dying. This zero-risk warfare is appealing to Western democratic leaders, with fewer returning body bags. They no longer fear public outcry and electoral losses. Remote war is sold to the public by emphasizing things like the precision of missiles and the care taken to avoid civilian casualties. For instance, the U.S. coalition commander at the time, General Stephen J. Townsend, challenged anyone to find a more precise air campaign in the history of warfare. The coalition's goal is always for zero human casualties. For coalition strategists, this new sort of perfect warfare based on smart technologies and proportionality principles allows them, in principle at least, to supposedly save the lives of not just Western military personnel, but also friendly civilians. So incidents that involve mass civilian casualties have the potential to undercut the legitimacy of not just a particular operation, but the new nature of warfare more broadly. This is why in situations such as the two outlined above, Western governments are secretive about the civilian harm their remote attacks cause and go to great lengths to keep these quiet. To uphold the myth of a clean war, officials turn to routine strategies of denial. Civilians didn't die. And secrecy. We cannot disclose whether civilians died because of operational security. However, if civilian casualties can no longer be kept under wraps, officials resort to emphasizing the sheer impossibility of knowing the identity of those targeted in the attack. With this, they ironically undermine their own precision discourse, exactly because airstrikes take place far away and there are no boots on the ground, it apparently is impossible to determine who dies in the attack. Regarding Hawija in Iraq, the Dutch Ministry of Defense initially claimed that only CENTCOM, the US Central Command, which led the so-called war against Daesh, had the authority and the capacity to establish the occurrence of civilian casualties in the Iraqi town of Hawija. But when CENTCOM subsequently acknowledged the 70 casualties were part of its official civilian body count, the Dutch defense minister at the time, Ank Bijleveld, argued that even CENTCOM could never know the true civilian nature of the casualties because of the difficulty of distinguishing retrospectively between Daesh terrorists and civilians. In many ways, the US responses to Baghouz echo this wrong logic by claiming that the civilian identity of the 80 people killed was inherently impossible to determine. This systematic and strategic refusal to know about the harm done to civilians undermines transparency, recognition, and accountability for human suffering in remote wars. It also undermines the ability of Western citizens and Western parliaments to exert democratic control over the wars waged in their name. This will make Western militaries more and not less war-prone, and allows for the continued unaccountable killing of innocent civilians. Monitoring organizations, journalists, academics, and military whistleblowers are doing their best to uncover and make visible the asymmetrical death and suffering that occurs as part of remote wars. It is now up to people in the West and their governments to care and to question the logic of this type of violence. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The role of the academic elite in making scientific discoveries. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country.
یه نکته دیگری که در باب نخبگان وجود داره من قبلها هم یه وقتایی به این اشاره کردم این است که یکی از هدفهای جامعه علمی کشور نه فقط نخبگان همه جوامع علمی البته در مورد نخبگان این بیشتر مورد نیاز هست این است که باید به مسائل کشور فکر کنن، مسئله محور کار کنن.
Another point about the academic elite, which I have mentioned once before as well, is that one of the goals of the country's scientific community, not just the academic elite, but all the scientific community, should be to think about the issues troubling the country and work in a problem-orientated way. Of course, in the case of the academic elite, this is even more necessary. Being problem-orientated is important. The country has fundamental issues which must receive attention. These must be solved scientifically.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
راه حل داره. الان همینجا دوستان ما چند تا از این مسائل رو مطرح کردن و براش راه حل ذکر کردن.
There is a solution for every problem. Right now, our friends have raised a few of these issues and suggested solutions. Of course, I said that judging these solutions requires reflection and deliberation, but it is possible to find a scientific solution to all the problems of the country. So one should confidently try to eliminate these problems. For example, one of our current issues is the issue of water in the country. This is one of the problems. One problem in the country is the shortage of water, and this will become a more important problem in the world in the very near future as well. Well, a scientific solution should be proposed.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.